As new COVID cases continue to set records in Texas, another statistic isn't tracking. Why are COVID death rates moving lower? That story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Texas teachers getting prepared for the first statewide public school elective on African American studies, how the past and present come together in the curriculum. Just how difficult is the process for obtaining a mail-in ballot in Texas? Our own Shelley Brisbane puts it to the test. And it's mergers and acquisitions on the menu, why food delivery services are gobbling each other up. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this second day of July 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us, and hope your Thursday's been a good one so far. The news on the coronavirus front, not so good right now. New coronavirus cases in the U.S. crossed the 50,000 mark on Wednesday. Nearly 53,000 new cases. That's the largest single-day total in the U.S. since the start of the pandemic. And Texas? Well, Texas reported more than 8,000 new COVID cases yesterday. It was among five states, breaking their previous single-day records for new cases. The other four are California, Arizona, North Carolina, and Georgia. But the numbers aren't all pointing in consistent directions, making it somewhat difficult to plan for the future. As it stands, for example, the governor has said public schools will be reopening in the fall, and though nationwide COVID transmission rates among kids have remained relatively low compared to the population at large, officials are concerned about what's happening in daycare centers in Texas, where COVID case numbers are climbing. The Texas Tribune reports today that more than 300 children have tested positive at 668 Texas child care centers. Then there's another data point that's puzzling to many. Though yesterday, Texas reported 57 COVID-related deaths since Tuesday, a new high, the COVID death rate in Texas is low, lower than much of the rest of the country, in fact, 8.4 deaths per 100,000 residents. That death rate has been falling since May 26th. Just how promising is this news, and how should we put it in context? Since the start of the pandemic, Dr. Fred Campbell has been joining us to field your questions about the coronavirus. He's an internal medicine specialist at UT Health San Antonio, and he joins us again on this Thursday. Dr. Campbell, welcome back.
It's wonderful to be back, David.
Why is Texas's COVID death rate relatively low?
I believe that the death rate in Texas is somewhat deceptive in that we have a lot of young people who have been out and in an attempt to open our economy, have exposed each other to COVID-19 and have become infected. Young people are not going to die from COVID for the most part. There are rare tragic deaths. What is likely, however, is that they will expose people that are more vulnerable just because of the very, very large numbers of infections. And so there will be a lag time before the death rate, particularly among our most vulnerable, increases. So I think at this point, we're really talking about a lag and some deceptiveness about Texas' death rate versus the rest of the country.
A lagging indicator. We've probably explained a death rate in the past here, but I'm wondering if you can unpack a few other terms for us. For example, one listener asked us, what's the difference between a hotspot and community spread?
In general, community spread means that COVID-19 can be readily passed by doing things that we must do, such as to go to the grocery store, fill up our cars, do the things that would be considered essential to continuing a reasonably normal economy under these circumstances. Mm-hmm. Hotspots are more typically places where we choose to go, such as bars, events, either entertainment events such as concerts or perhaps even political events, those kinds of situations where people are perhaps not being as smart about masking and social distancing would be real hotspots for COVID-19 transmission.
Here's a good question from Brooke Jacobs we received on Facebook. How old is the COVID-19 data that gets released each day from the Department of State Health Services? And is there a way to estimate the actual number of positive cases from it?
I went directly to the website yesterday to assess just how up-to-date, and I noticed that the update had been put down as a couple of hours before I actually accessed it. So I think we're dealing with some very up-to-date information. Generally, these are estimates, but what the state is trying to do is to collect the total number of cases and the total number of people who have recovered that have been reported, and the difference between those two numbers tends to, again, to be a reasonably good estimate of the active cases.
Got another listener question for you, Dr. Campbell. What do we know about the lasting effects of COVID-19 post-recovery?
That is a very difficult question. I know that there's been great publicity about celebrities even who have lost limbs and had incredibly bad outcomes from COVID-19. People that are at high risk in general are more likely to develop worsening of their chronic conditions, such as worsening kidney disease from being in ICU and on ventilators for long periods of time, worsening of cardiovascular disease, and certainly a lasting impact on the lungs, although that is variable and it is a case-to-case situation. The most devastating thing, I believe, long-term is going to be what's called ICU syndrome. If you've been in the ICU and on the ventilator for a prolonged period of time, the likelihood of having significant cognitive deficits and emotional overlay is very, very high.
Dr. Fred Campbell is an internal medicine specialist at UT Health San Antonio. You can check out more of his answers to more of your questions related to the coronavirus at texasstandard.org/coronavirus. Dr. Campbell, thanks again.
Thank you, David. It's a privilege.
With early voting and the primary runoffs beginning this week, we've been turning a spotlight on some of the most closely watched races across the state. One of them is Congressional District 24, which covers much of the suburban area between Dallas and Fort Worth, a key political battleground. There, two Democrats are fighting to take on Republican Beth Van Dyne in November in hopes of flipping a seat won by incumbent Republican Kenny Marchant in 2004. KERA's Saida Hassan has more.
At a park in Irving, a couple dozen volunteers sit at picnic tables, packing Ziploc bags with gloves, face masks, and hand sanitizer. They plan to hand out 5,000 of these safety kits to voters before the July runoff. Jerry Yass is co-founder of the group Dems Care Vote Safe, which organized the event.
We have to show them that we care. And to me, these kits are showing that we care enough about you. We care about your voice and your vote and your safety. So please come up and exercise your right.
Yass says she doesn't want fear of the coronavirus to deter voters. In the Democratic runoff for Texas's 24th congressional district, her group is supporting Kim Olson, whose campaign co-hosted the Safety Kit event. Olson is a retired Air Force colonel and a top fundraiser who finished first in the March primary.
I have a proven track record of leading, especially in environments that are kind of crisis-filled, and I would offer to you, we have the perfect storm of economic, health, and social unrest crisis right now, which I think takes leaders who have a steady hand and understand the big picture and the strategic point and how things are going to have to happen in order to have basically systemic change in our country.
Olson faces Candace Valenzuela. She served on the school board for the Carrollton Farmers Branch District and earned a number of high-profile endorsements.
I'm rooted in the community. That's a key difference between me and my opponent right now. I'm working to lift up the families here. I'm working to support the teachers in my school district who have been responsible for some of the most important work in the suburban majority person of color community.
Since the primary, the runoff campaign has become contentious. Matt Liebman is president of the Voter Protection Project, a national political action committee that's endorsed Valenzuela. The group has spent more than $130,000 on a direct mailer campaign. It attacks Kim Olson's record as then head of human resources for the Dallas Independent School District, calling it a complete disaster.
I think the records are really clear, and I think voters should know the contrast between these two candidates and, you know, what they stand for.
Olson's campaign calls the mailers patently false. The candidates have also clashed over their responses to ongoing protests against police brutality. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who is white, killed George Floyd, a black man. Floyd's death last month spurred massive protests, including many in North Texas. Kim Olson, who is white, has faced bipartisan criticism for comments about looting that some considered flippant. Candace Valenzuela, who is black and Latina, said Olson, quote, missed the mark and should have instead amplified the voices of black people. A later statement from Olson's campaign called for rebuilding a, quote, colorblind public safety institution. That language was criticized by Valenzuela and the Congressional Black Caucus. Olson later clarified,
justice is supposed to be blind to your socioeconomic status, the color of your skin, and we know today that that is absolutely not true, that police force and African Americans are killed in the street at a higher proportionality rate. And if the choice of words offend people, then that we do not want to do, and that's one of the things we can work on.
Candace Valenzuela says she understands the urgency of addressing systemic racism, something she's experienced firsthand.
A good representative body actually represents the people. And in Congress, we're not seeing that with gender. We're not seeing that with color. We're not seeing that with disability. We're not seeing that with sexuality. And all of these different experiences individually are not the biggest thing in choosing an elected official, but they're a part of the fabric of the American experience.
The winner of this race will face off against former Irving Mayor Beth Van Dyne in November. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
He's monitoring the Talk of Texas on this Thursday. Our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, that is. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. COVID-19's impact on children and families is a hot topic, especially the question of schools' plans for the fall. A story taking off from the New York Times website this morning. In the COVID-19 economy, you can have a kid or a job. You can't have both. It calls for a more concerted focus on safely reopening schools in the fall. Meanwhile, on our Facebook page, Herman Torres notes that the Texas Education Agency is still waiting to announce its so-called guidance, but their silence has already imparted one message to parents: you're on your own. Some of the responses we're seeing out there, David. In other news, you wouldn't expect Vanilla Ice, of all performers, to break the internet in this, the year of our Lord 2020, but that's precisely what's happened after word spread the one-hit wonders playing a concert amid the pandemic in music-starved Austin, Texas. I'll be back with the chilling details later in the show.
Nice, nice, baby. Hey, listen, Texas, we need to hear from you. Let us know what's making news in your part of Texas. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar with more of your comments in 35 minutes or so as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Today is the deadline to request a mail-in ballot for the July 14th election. Advocacy groups had filed lawsuits to expand voting by mail because of the coronavirus threat, but those suits failed. So, to qualify for a mail-in ballot in Texas, you still must be at least 65 years of age or older, jailed but otherwise eligible to vote, traveling outside your home county on election day, or have a disability. The Texas Standard's Shelley Brisbane is eligible to vote by mail, so she decided to give the process a try.
I like going out to cast a ballot. Whether it's standing in line at the little church in my neighborhood on election day, or voting early at the grocery store before I buy the makings for dinner, voting in person makes me feel good. I have what's called low vision. I don't drive, and the well-meaning poll workers usually offer me a magnifying glass when I step up to the voting machine. Though my disability qualifies me to vote by mail in Texas, I've never done it. I've always had other options, and it's very important for me to participate in life just the way anyone else does. This time around, though, I have to admit, COVID-19 was on my mind. If I vote in person, do I risk getting the virus on the bus or at the vote center, even if I wear a mask? If I were infected without knowing it, could I give the virus to someone else? My elderly mother, perhaps? So I reluctantly made the decision to cast my ballot by mail. There are three steps to voting by mail in Texas. First, you fill out a request for a mail-in ballot. Then you send that request to your county election office. That's the part you have to get done today. Once your ballot arrives in the mail, you fill it out and mail it back so that it's postmarked by election day. Be aware, you need to be registered to vote before you make a vote-by-mail request. So here's what the first part of that process sounds like. To get started, I typed vote-by-mail-Texas into my web browser. My search took me directly to the Secretary of State's website.
Vote-by-mail-Texas, application for a ballot by mail.
And as I go through this, you'll hear my screen reader. It speaks text on the screen to assist someone who is blind or has low vision. And it's pretty great for radio, too.
Instructions for submitting
the Secretary of State's site has instructions for how to proceed.
Link 1. Print PDF. The ABBM form.
Now I'm downloading the application for a ballot by mail.
Last name. Please print information. Edit text.
The form appears on my screen, and I can either print it and fill it out by hand or fill it out online with my computer. I'll do it online. I'll need to mark my reason for requesting to vote by mail, so I'll check disability. There are other blanks for different voting situations, but I'm almost done. I'll check the party whose primary I'll be voting in and the any resulting runoff box, since the election includes a runoff. If I plan to vote by mail again, I could check annual application to receive ballots for elections during the rest of the calendar year. All I have left to do is print and sign the form. If I had asked someone to help me fill out the application, which is allowed, they would have had to add their contact info and signature, which confirms that they're acting at my request. Some counties accept emailed or faxed applications to vote by mail. If yours does, you'll also need to mail the original form to the elections office. Get the address on the county elections website. Once I've signed the form, I'll drop it into the mail. Sometime during the early voting period, I should receive my ballot from the county. I'll mark my choices and return it postmarked by Election Day, July 14th. Here's hoping I'll be back at my neighborhood polling place come November. I'm Shelley Brisbane for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/on the job.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Food delivery companies have been flourishing since everyone locked down because of the coronavirus. Uber Eats sales have doubled since the pandemic began, but now that success is giving way to a flurry of mergers and acquisitions in the sector, and it isn't clear that combos like the possible Uber takeover of Postmates will be good for the industry's long-term bottom line, or how local restaurants and consumers might fare in the process. Our go-to tech expert, Omar Gayaga, has been watching the industry rearrange itself, as well as writing about turmoil in Austin's food delivery economy. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Have you used some of these delivery services in the past? You must have.
I have. I mean, I was a big Uber Eats fan when they first hit Austin, and I've used several of them. I always come back to, like, do the fees make sense? You know, when you add in the driver tip, when you add in the delivery fees, you want to make sure the restaurant is getting paid. I mean, it ends up being like $23, $24 for a single sandwich sometimes. So like it seems to make a lot more sense when you're ordering as a group or, you know, placing a large order. It's, you know, small orders.
Yeah.
The economics of it never made sense to me.
No, I totally get it. But the economics do seem to make sense to a lot of these big companies. You mentioned Uber Eats. There's been a potential merger of Uber and Postmates that's been making a lot of headlines after, I guess, Uber failed to buy Grubhub earlier this year. What do you think's going on there, and why would such a merger, what would it mean for food delivery options? Let's just do that for starters.
Yeah, I think what's happening is what we kind of thought was going to happen a couple of years ago when these companies started blowing up is, you know, consolidation. Like, there's too many of them. There's, you know, six or seven options in every city, and you're starting to see them start to swallow each other up. So we have Uber pursuing Postmates. They were previously trying to get Grubhub to purchase them, but Grubhub was instead purchased by a European company called Just Eat Takeaway. So you've got these billion-dollar valuations of these companies, but there's just too many options, and they're really not making profits. I mean, that's the thing. They're dumping all of this money into expanding these services and expanding their the people that use them, but they're not particularly profitable. So that's what's happening right now.
You mentioned Uber Eats. That's sort of a side business to its transportation services. It seems to me that maybe DoorDash is the big player in this market. Am I right there? Are they buying up competitors too?
They're not the one you hear about most often, but they've gotten very huge just by kind of quietly acquiring companies like Caviar. Last year, they bought from Square. Again, another Square is a company you don't associate with food delivery, but they had a food delivery service called Caviar. They recently raised $400 million. This is DoorDash, and they are valued at about $16 billion. Again, but how much of that is profit? You know, like, they're not making a lot of profit. These companies are dumping a lot of money into these kind of loss leader services.
Consumers may be a little ambivalent on some of these services, but on the local level, you wrote recently about how restaurants in the Texas capital city are more dependent on delivery services now than ever before. But you say there's a lot of contention between them and those delivery services, right?
Yeah, I spoke to some restaurant owners in the Austin area, and some of them said, you know, we were not really overly concerned with delivery. I mean, it's there, it's a necessary evil, but usually they would pick, you know, one service that they liked and kind of stick with that. The pandemic really forced their hand to kind of go all in on delivery and takeout. So they have really had to partner with these companies and kind of accept them in a way that maybe they wouldn't have if there wasn't so much of their business shifting to delivery and takeout.
Interesting. Now, let's talk about a Texas-based service, a company like Favor, right? They're owned by HEB and they operate in a few markets. How can they stand out and succeed and perhaps, I guess, differentiate themselves with some kind of better option? Or is that a possibility in this marketplace?
What I heard from restaurant owners, one in particular in Austin, the Soup Peddler, was that they have had good luck with working with Favor more directly, that they actually get a person on the phone when they call. They actually can get help when something goes wrong with an order. They can work out a special deal, perhaps, to get tips back to their wait staff. So, you know, Favor seems like it has more flexibility and has been working better with local companies. But does that scale nationally? We don't know. I mean, that right now, that seems to be a thing that Austin restaurant owners are experiencing, but it may not work when you expand a service like that on a much bigger scale.
Mergers and acquisitions on the menu. Omar Gayaga talks about all things tech over at techminutetexas.com. Omar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We are fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour at Texas Standard Time. The Texas Roundup, our comprehensive look at what's making news in the Lone Star State, is just around the corner. Stick around.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Community activists are skeptical of a new policy the Dallas Police Department announced this week. Chief Renee Hall says DPD will now release videos less than 3 days after officers shoot someone or are accused of using excessive force resulting in serious injury or death. Chonga Higgins chairs the Dallas Community Police Oversight Coalition.
I'm just waiting to see what actually the general order looks like and how much of the recommendations did she take from the Office of Community Police Oversight.
A copy of the new policy the Dallas Morning News obtained shows Chief Hall still has discretion in releasing videos. An audit of the Houston Police Department's Narcotics Division shows officers and supervisors made repeated policy violations. Houston Public Media's Davis Land has details.
The report was ordered after a no-knock drug raid last year that killed two people, their pet dog, and injured several officers. It shows officers and supervisors in the Narcotics Division made repeated policy violations in how they planned and handled operations. The report found hundreds of errors in documenting cases, getting proper oversight into investigations, and handling confidential informants. Houston police released the report on Twitter last night. While auditors found violations of policy, they made no conclusions about whether those actions were illegal or not. They've left that to the district attorney's office. Yesterday, Harris County prosecutors announced criminal charges against a total of 6 police officers. I'm Davis Land in Houston.
Also in Houston, a number of groups, including the Texas Medical Association, are calling on the Texas Republican Party to reconsider holding its state convention in person. It's scheduled for the George R. Brown Convention Center later this month. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner says while he thinks the event should be virtual, because he's a Democrat, he's staying out of it.
Yeah, the governor, the lieutenant governor, statewide officials, all of these individuals are members of the state Republican state convention. Why should I police their convention?
The state Republican Executive Committee meets tonight to discuss the convention. And the Texas Farm Bureau president says the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which took effect Wednesday, is good for agricultural producers. Russell Boehning says a third of the net farm income in Texas comes from exports, adding Mexico and Canada are the state's biggest trading partners.
And in those exports, beef is always either first or second. Cotton is either first or second. And we both know that those are the two biggest commodities grown in Texas.
The USMCA replaces NAFTA. I'm Joseph Leahy.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The mayor of Leveland, a South Plains town of about 13,000, shared a racist, debunked post on her personal Facebook page last weekend. She's apologized, but some residents say it's not enough and are asking her to resign. Texas Tech Public Media's Casey Ellingson reports now from Lubbock.
Leveland's Mayor Barbara Pinner received backlash from residents after she shared a Facebook post containing racial slurs over the weekend. Tuesday night, citizens gathered in City Hall to have a conversation with the mayor concerning her post. Media was not permitted at the event. The audio you hear was provided by Leveland resident Manuel Mendez.
I have a question. Would you have read that to us, to our faces? That's what I want to know. You posted it on Facebook.
Uh-oh, yeah.
But would you read it? Would you read it to us, to our faces?
No.
So why'd you post it?
Several of the mayor's constituents are now calling for her resignation. Leveland native Daryl Phillips, who was also at the meeting, shares his impression of the post.
It says, a former wrote this. That right there, I hadn't even got past a former wrote this yet. When I read that, I was done with it.
The post she shared appears to be a letter written from the perspective of a dying black man. In it, he shares negative views on Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin, two victims of police brutality. It uses the N-word at least 20 times, and even includes the term untrained monkeys. The fact-checking site Snopes.com has not been able to verify that this text was actually written by an older black man, but it's been in circulation since 2014.
I'll be the first to say I'm not shocked, but I am because she, first of all, is the mayor.
Mendez is a lifelong resident of Leveland and a former city council and school board member. He's known the mayor for many years.
And what she reposted, she should have never done that. Just not an appropriate way of being a leader, and I want her to resign.
Pinner was elected to mayor in 2015 and is serving her second 3-year term in office. After deleting the controversial post, she published an apology on her Facebook page. It reads, "This morning I shared a post written by an older black gentleman that I thought was very well written, but apparently several people have taken offense." She goes on to dispute allegations that she is racist and apologizes if she's offended anyone. On Monday, she issued a formal apology for her actions, and on Tuesday night held that closed-door meeting. Melanie Robbins was there, and she says the mood of the room was dominated by hurt from attendees, most of whom were black.
This affects me personally, because I take it personally, because of what you did. You thought nothing of what it would appear like to us.
And I tell people all the time, if you want to be racist at your house and, you know, do whatever, I mean, I can't tell you, you know, what to do with your life, but when you're over my kids, when you're over my city, when you're in a place of leadership where you affect me and mine, I'm not going to tolerate a racist being in that spot, because we've tolerated that for too long already, and we're not going to tolerate it anymore.
I have 3 questions for the first question. What was she trying to get out of this post? The second question, dealing with African-American constituents, what message were you relaying to them with this post? And what gave you comfort in releasing a post like this?
Phillips was born and raised in Loveland. He and Robbins grew up together, and like her, he lives in Lubbock now, but he's still closely connected to his hometown. He says growing up in Loveland, he experienced a lot of racism. One incident sticks out in his memory. In high school, back in 1981, he recalls a pep rally for a game against Estacado High School, where students set fire to a black mannequin.
That was one of the first incidents that we've seen. You just know where you're supposed to stand in Loveland when growing up.
Mendez grew up in Loveland too, and he agrees that the city has a problem with racism. He says it's embedded in the community of over 13,000, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it.
Like, they're talking about the COVID. Some people are asymptomatic and they don't know it. And then you end up getting a lot of sick people. That's what she is. She's asymptomatic. She don't think she is racist, but then it reared its ugly head and the true colors came out of how she really is.
The meeting ended abruptly with attendees demanding her resignation and Pinner refusing. A few, including Robbins, stormed out.
Are you stepping down?
Robin says the group is dedicated to seeing Pinner removed from office, and they're working to pursue the next step in that process. Our reporters reached out to the mayor for a statement, but didn't receive a response by the time of broadcast. I'm Casey Ellingson.
Houston Methodist Hospital took out a giant front page wraparound ad in today's Houston Chronicle asking people to stay home this 4th of July. The ad mimics the look of a front page and wraps around the folded paper. It warns that even being with family and friends presents a risk of spreading COVID-19, and it goes through the recommended suggestions of wearing a mask, social distancing, and washing your hands if you must leave your home this weekend. Houston Methodist has seen a surge in hospital cases and is working to expand bed availability. This just days after announcing they would start scheduling surgeries once again. Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Back in April, the State Board of Education, which sets policies and standards for Texas public schools, approved the creation of an African American Studies course to be offered to Texas high school students as an elective. Texas public high schools could be offering African American Studies courses as soon as this upcoming school year. So how are some Texas teachers preparing, especially after a summer of Black Lives Matter protests against police brutality and growing calls for the United States to reckon with its racism? Carla Broadus might know. She's director of African American Studies at the University of Texas in San Antonio. And beginning next month, she'll be offering online workshops for teachers in San Antonio and across the state on how to teach an African American Studies curriculum in high school. Thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard. We certainly do appreciate it.
I'm enjoying the opportunity.
First, since you are teaching the teachers, is what it sounds like to me, what exactly will you be teaching in these courses?
Well, first off, what I've done is I looked at what the state mandated that was necessary under the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills for African American Studies, mm-hmm. so that we would have the exact information of what was approved for our classroom teachers in the state of Texas to learn. It's going to be an elective course. And what they've done is they've broken down. Students will be able to learn African American Studies government information. Mm-hmm. And so it's how the government was structure impacted the slaves and the African Americans, what was involved in obtaining citizenship and maintaining citizenship, such as even the impacts of voting or not being able to vote. Mm-hmm. So we've broken it down into different areas for us to address. They're not real. They did not offer them the books and those materials. So we're trying to do that as well so that the classroom teachers have guidelines for where they can go and even locate the materials.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you, for instance, what sort of story would you recommend? I mean, obviously, there's no way to talk about the entire curriculum. But for example, what would you say, you can't leave this part out, and this is something that's been perhaps overlooked in the past?
Well, for instance, I'm going to discuss the economic portion for our first workshop. And I feel it's, and it is a part of the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills, I feel that we need to talk about the monetary connection to slavery. And that's something that a lot of people don't bring up. They will hear something about Eli Whitney and the cotton gin, but we aren't connecting the cotton gin was a way for more cotton to be produced, which then filtered into the pockets of slave owners. So we're not making the connections for the students to understand how those things connected. We aren't talking about how after slavery, many of the African Americans set up little freedmen's areas throughout Texas and in some of the other states, where they set up all of their economic livelihood so that they could exist, set up stores, bought land, took care of everything for themselves. We don't discuss that. We don't talk about how African Americans were introduced into the National Labor Union and what that meant and what impact that had. That's even on, that's a part of the Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills.
Let me ask you about how current events factor into the curriculum. How do you, obviously there are a lot of people expressing interest in part because of what we're currently experiencing on the national and world stage. Do you try to incorporate what's been going on into the curriculum that you're hoping young people will be able to pick up on in a semester like what you're preparing teachers for?
Most definitely. Quite frankly, I just got through trying to find out one particular trade book. Keep in mind, my background also is in reading and literacy. The Hate U Give is a young adult text, not textbook, but trade book that's out there talking about Black Lives Matter. And I was double checking and saw where it's been blacklisted in many school districts. And I'm not sure what districts are going to do in 2020 to allow students to read that book. So we're looking at books that we can say, maybe you want to have this book read in your classroom, and trying to double check whether or not they have been placed on an acceptable read list.
What does it mean to you personally to be able to teach some of the teachers of the first curriculum courses for this African American Studies class for Texas high school teachers?
This, to me, is somewhat of an honor. This is a privilege.
What do you ultimately hope people attending these online courses get out of the experience?
One, I want them to make sure that they have the information on the historical parts and the economic parts, the geography, the cultural information. I want them to have basic, correct information. I want them to make sure that they know that there is a difference between indentured servitude and slavery. Because in our state, if you remember, not that long ago, it was decided to take the term slavery out of the textbook. And there's an extremely different thing. It means two different things, indentured servitude and slavery. And knowing the difference. So I want them to have facts that make our students so that if they're down marching or planning to march at a later date, they know why they're marching.
Carla Broadus is Director of African American Studies at the University of Texas in San Antonio. Next month, Professor Broadus will be hosting online courses for Texas teachers, where she'll be going over how to teach African American studies to Texas high school students. The SBOE recently approved African American studies to be taught in state high schools as an elective. Ms. Broadus, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
The deans of all 10 Texas law schools recently sent a letter seeking alternatives to the in-person bar exam schedule for the end of this month. The letter asked the State Board of Law Examiners to cancel or postpone the test due to the coronavirus pandemic, according to the Texas Tribune. Other options suggested by the law school deans: moving to an online format or admitting graduates to the bar without taking the exam. Over 1,000 students have already signed up to take the exam in person, where the board plans to supply masks and enforce social distancing. The final decisions is in the hands of the Texas Supreme Court, and we're hearing they could have a decision as soon as today. We will keep you posted. Coming up on 49 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, dedicated to the fight against cancer through telemedicine, providing patients with the ability to conduct online virtual appointments. More at TexasOncology.com.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. As many Texans have taken to the streets to protest the police killings of George Floyd and other black Americans, some demonstrators say they were wrongly arrested while protesting peacefully. Now, three of those protesters are suing. They say the Texas anti-rioting statute unfairly snares lawful protesters. Lily Godinez, Yolanda McGriff, and Megan Nordyke, all of Dallas, are challenging the law in a suit filed in federal court in Dallas. Joining us now, Miles Moffitt. He's an investigative reporter at the Dallas Morning News and co-reported this story with the news's Diane Solis. Miles, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
These three women say they were peacefully protesting when they were arrested. Do you recall the circumstances surrounding their arrests?
The circumstances, according to the family members who are with them, is that they were heading downtown to protest peacefully. At least in two cases, they had witnesses, family members, and then and that was Lily Godinez and Yolanda McGriff, who was there with her 16-year-old daughter and was separated from her as soon as she was arrested. And then Megan Nordyke, photographs of the scene show she was, you know, kind of this solitary figure walking around with a sign warning police that she's a lawyer and she's monitoring their moves.
What's notable about these arrests and the arrests of a handful of others during Dallas protests is that they were charged with riot participation, and that's raising questions about the state's anti-rioting statute. What is that law itself, and is it unique to Texas?
It is not unique to Texas. There's also a federal anti-riot statute, but the law aims at basically detaining people who appear to be causing violence, threatening violence in an organized way. And that's the very weakness of the law, according to others, many lawyers in the state who say that it, you know, essentially can trap people by guilt through association.
So is that the central argument these three women in Dallas are making in their lawsuit? Do they have a constitutional claim, say First Amendment or something along those lines?
Right. They you know, their accounts were that they went out to peacefully protest. They were carrying signs. They say the officers apparently didn't like. One of them was tackled. All three of them were corralled into a van and taken to jail that night, where they met for the first time and, you know, were able to, well, it brought them together in a very, you know, traumatic way, but now they're trying to take their power back.
So has this law been challenged before in Texas, to your knowledge?
Back in the late 70s, it was, and the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas said that, you know, the law needed to be narrowed and clarified, And essentially, they toughened up the standard for proof, saying you need to establish that they had knowledge they were doing something that was criminal or threatening other people.
So what about elsewhere in the country? You mentioned that there are similar statutes. How have laws like these been addressed in other places?
Well, California's law last year was challenged, ironically, by three white supremacists who were claimed they were merely expressing their free speech rights, and the judge agreed with them, saying that the law, essentially was, overly broad, and was taking aim at their First Amendment rights. And he had an interesting quote saying one man's protest could be another's riot. And I think in terms of law enforcement, what we're seeing is that these cases illustrate, almost an expectation, an attitude that they, are expecting a riot when in effect these people are merely expressing opinions that the police don't like.
Miles Moffitt is an investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to his latest at TexasStandard.org. Miles, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us again is our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Wells, what do you got there?
Howdy, David. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the story of a one Robert Van Winkle, a.k.a. Vanilla Ice, has the internet abuzz as word of a planned 4th of July concert in music-deprived Austin, Texas spreads. So performances, obviously, have been effectively ended in the once and future live music capital of the world ever since bars closed in Austin again. But as the Austin Chronicle helpfully explains in a post on its website that's gone viral, the lakeside venue Mr. Ice is playing is technically not a bar, but a restaurant, so this gig looks slated to continue. The timing of the event here amid a global pandemic with this particular performer, as you might expect, has piqued some reactions on the internet, so to speak. I love this tweet from Dom DeFurio at the Dallas Morning News. He tweets, "If you're trying to risk getting COVID just to see Vanilla Ice, my direct messages are open. No story. I just want to talk." And I think that is an interesting thing to put out there. On our Facebook page, Laquette Manley helpfully notes that the upper end of ticket prices here is $300. As for the Iceman himself, he's come under a little bit of fire for downplaying it. I believe one prominent quote we've seen circling the internet is, "In the 90s, we didn't have the coronavirus." He's since gone to Twitter to sort of clarify things a little bit. He tweets, "I take the coronavirus serious, but we can't live in a bubble. I think at this point we all understand the severity of it. Practice social distancing and wear a mask." And he also notes this is an outside venue, the 4th of July on the lake with fireworks. Plenty of room for distancing. So getting to a little bit of the kernel of a real conversation there about, obviously the pandemic isn't going anywhere. How soon can we resume things, events like this practically and safely? But obviously with cases continuing to spike in Texas, maybe not the right time for that conversation just yet.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. The last I heard of him, he was in the construction business in Florida or something like that. Maybe
yeah, didn't
doing some
he
reality
have,
TV
like, yeah,
work.
Has some reality TV show flipping homes on the side. I don't know if he hails. Yeah, he does hail from Texas, South Dallas to be exact. Hmm. Dallas, Texas, per Wikipedia. Well, speaking of other Dallas stories, interesting one I saw come up from BuzzFeed News yesterday about First Baptist Church in Dallas, where we just saw the Vice President Mike Pence there last Sunday.
Right.
The headline there from BuzzFeed, Mike Pence, or the coronavirus spread in a Dallas megachurch's choir and orchestra. Then it hosted Pence. The news outlet getting its hands on some internal emails that showed some five members of the choir tested positive for coronavirus in June. Those members did not perform among the choir members that did sing without masks for the Vice President on Sunday, but obviously that question of whether or not the virus could have spread asymptomatically, issues like that. Interesting story that we will link on our Twitter and Facebook pages there, to be sure.
Yeah, you bet. Another story that we're tracking, Congress eyeing more spending as virus surges and economy struggles. Apparently, Republicans and Democrats on the Hill thinking about new aid for workers and businesses. This is one of many stories we continue to track. You can keep up with all the news 24/7 at texasstandard.org. We'll be back here on the radio tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.